Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices. Well, I am really excited today. We are talking to Dr. Michelle Ouellette. She is a veterinarian that I work with Partners for Wildlife at the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota. And today, we're going to talk about animal welfare. Now, you may not think it's an exciting subject, but wait until you hear about it, because it really is. It has a lot of components that really do play with wildlife rehabilitation and things that we should be thinking about. But at first, of course, we have to kind of know what it is. So welcome, Dr. Ouellette. Really happy that you're here today. And oh, by the way, I've got to tell everybody that we're also friends, and I'm pretty proud of that. we have quite a few things in common, so it's very, very fun. So welcome. And before we get started, I wanted to ask you just a little bit about all the letters behind your name. You have DVM, which is, of course, a doctorate of veterinary medicine, correct?
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah, that's correct. And then MPH, which I also know, which is a master's of public health. But you also have DACVPM. Could you explain what that is for everybody listening?
Thanks, Gail. Well, first of all, I have to say I'm very excited to be talking to you as well, because as you said, we have been friends for a really long time, and you're actually responsible for me being at the Raptor Center. So,
oh, that's right. That's a whole nother podcast episode we can talk about. I'd forgotten about that. But DACVPM?
So DACVPM stands for Diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Preventative Medicine. So, and a college is, so this is a board certification. So many of you have gone to your physician who may be board certified in dermatology or board certified as an orthopedic surgeon. So it's a specialty degree after you graduate from your medical or veterinary school. It means you've had some additional training in that particular field. Often that training involves having a 2 or 3 year residency. And sometimes it is involved, the certificate can be more along the lines of independent learning, especially if there's not a residency program available for that specialty. So American College of Veterinary Preventive Medicine involves public health. Obviously, public health involves animals. I know that you've already talked about zoonotic diseases, those diseases that go back and forth between people and animals. So obviously, veterinarians are very involved in public health, if nothing else for zoonotic diseases, but it's much broader than that.
Excellent. And you mentioned that this was, you had maybe a residency, but and it's after your veterinary degree. I kind of understand that because of the Master's of Public Health, where you would be very interested in this, but why pursue a board certification in this?
Well, my background is actually in zoological medicine. I always wanted to be a zoo. I always wanted to be a veterinarian. And when I was an undergrad, I was walking through a local zoo and thought to myself, I'll bet they have veterinarians here too. So a plan was born, and I went into zoological medicine. And so I was a zoo vet for a variety of zoos for over 20 years.
Wow.
But I wanted to go more into public health, one health, ecosystem health. As I mentioned, veterinarians are very much a part of that, especially zoo veterinarians, because it's involved with people, it's involved with animals, it's involved with the environment. It's looking at a very big picture. And in order to do that, I needed a little bit more schooling. So I migrated from the zoo to the Raptor Center. Again, thanks to you. And
everybody, it's recorded. She gave me credit for that.
And moved from zoological medicine into wildlife rehabilitation and raptor medicine and surgery. And along with that, I had the opportunity here at the university to finish up my master's in public health and then again start studying for this board certification, which I achieved about 5 years after that.
So. Wow, excellent, excellent. So what kind of spurred your interest in all of this, the public health part and the rehabilitation and the zoonotic diseases and preventive medicine and all of that? Was there something in particular?
No, it's just as zoological veterinarians, you know, we deal with all of these different species. We have to deal with the staff that are working on the zoo grounds. We have to deal with the public who are coming to the zoo grounds. We're also involved in conservation projects. So we are dealing with free-ranging animals, free-ranging wildlife, and it really is all connected. It isn't just about physicians looking at people and veterinarians looking at animals and botanists looking at plants. It's about how we are all connected. And health is a big part of that. And so I just wanted to explore that further.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for that. So then along with that, we're going to talk a little bit later about the fact that you're pursuing another board certification in animal welfare. And today's subject is animal welfare. But how did you get interested in animal welfare?
Well, as a veterinarian, I would like to think that I was always interested in animal welfare. I was thinking back on that a little bit, and I remember that when I was a child, I used to get literature from the Humane Society and put it in the mailboxes of my neighbors who I didn't think were taking care of their animals quite correctly, until I found out that was a federal offense.
Whoops. They may have been lenient on you.
Yeah,
maybe.
Well, and of course, my didn't do much for my parents' relationship with our neighbors either. So I kind of quit doing that. But I've mentioned the term One Health, this interconnection between the health of humans, animals, and the environment. Well, there is a sister concept of One Welfare, in that the welfare of animals and people and the environment are also all connected. So it was a very nice conversion from one to the other.
Yeah, transition. I see that. Boy, do I love that. I love that one animal welfare, you know, one health, animal welfare, kind of a sister concept. That's really lovely. I mean, it brought to mind everything from forest bathing to, you know, seeing wildlife in the wild and spending time in nature and, you know, a lot of those different kinds of things. That's certainly the human-centric part of it, but I love that concept. That's great.
Well, and especially as I moved more into wildlife rehabilitation, because to me that's just, welfare is a central tenet for wildlife rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. Do I learn lots of other things about their health, my health, the environmental health from looking at animals that are brought in for rehabilitation? Yes. Mm-hmm. Especially raptors, because they are at the top of the trophic sphere. They're much like us. They're very much at the top of that pyramid. So things that influence them also influence us. So we can learn from raptors that are coming into rehabilitation about our health and about our environment and those things that affect us. But looking at it from the animal's point of view, it's really all about their welfare. Mm-hmm. They are sick, injured, displaced, and often because of human interference.
Okay.
And so it's about improving their welfare.
Right. Oh, excellent. One of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, you're a veterinarian, and you had to take an oath. That's correct, right? And so is animal welfare mentioned in the oath?
I smile because I just think that is so interesting, and it kind of goes along with the evolution of animal welfare and veterinary medicine and society. So animal welfare, animals were mentioned in the oath. Welfare was not mentioned in the oath that I took. And you can't see me. You in the audience can't see me, but I have very gray hair. I've been here a really long time. It was not in the oath that I took decades ago. But to me, it was assumed. So instead of animal health, it's now animal health and welfare. And instead of the relief of animal suffering, it is the prevention and relief of animal suffering. And it was explicitly added, those particular phrases were added in 2010, to ensure that animal welfare is seen as a priority by veterinarians taking the oath. And again, I was just kind of very surprised that, of course, it was part of our oath, even though we didn't spell out those words. But it was, again, as more of society became involved with and concerned with animal welfare, it was seen as something that we should be sure that everyone knows that it is front and center, that it's, again, not just health, but health and welfare, and not just prevention of suffering or the relief of suffering, but the prevention of suffering. And it also fed into, we talked about the board specialty for animal welfare. Again, that comes out through the American Veterinary Medical Association. And about the same time, they started looking into making a veterinary specialty for animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And so that's the one I'm studying for now.
Excellent. So maybe just a little bit about the board certification for animal welfare. What all is involved in that?
So it is the newest specialty college. And as such, they are just beginning to get residencies up and running now. So there's a residency in Ohio State for veterinarians and animal welfare. And North Carolina, I think, will be having one on board very soon. I'm a little old to go back for a 3-year residency, so I'm doing the self-study tract for board specialties, and it involves of a certain number of years of experience in dealing with animal welfare issues. It involves writing peer-reviewed articles that are accepted into journals that have an animal welfare focus. And it involves a lot of studying for a very large exam, which will take me 2 days to get through. But it'll be a couple of years before I sit for that exam. Like I said, I have papers to write, and I have to do 6 or 8 formal animal welfare assessments on a variety of different species in a variety of different situations. So I'll be working on that for a while.
So for those of us who think that we are busy, Let me just tell you that Dr. Mitch is busier still. Wow, congratulations on working toward that. Oh, that's pretty amazing. So we've been throwing this term out, animal welfare, quite a bit here, but what is the definition of animal welfare?
It's really interesting because there is not one formal definition of animal welfare. There are different definitions from different organizations. So the American Veterinary Medical Association has a definition of animal welfare. There is a World Association, a World Organization of Animal Health. It also has a definition of animal welfare. I came from the zoo world. We have a definition of animal welfare. So we have lots of little definitions out there about animal welfare. They don't exactly say the same thing, but they all have the same inference. Animal welfare is the state of the animal. The definition that I like is the one about it is how the animal is coping with its environment, regardless of what that environment is, whether we're talking about an animal undergoing rehabilitation, an animal in a zoo, an animal in a research setting, even free-ranging wild animals. It's about how they are coping with the situation that they are in. It varies from moment to moment. Just like you have moments where you're having really excellent welfare, and then there are times, multiple times during the day, when it's not so great, or for longer periods of time, if we're sick or we're having some other kind of difficulties, where our welfare is more in a negative aspect, not necessarily a positive aspect. And it often centers around three different areas or spheres. So we talk about being your physical health, your physiological, how your physiology is working. We talk about your mental or your emotional health. Mm-hmm. And we also talk about either environmental or social when we're talking about humans, or behavioral when we're talking about animals. And these three spheres overlap and they interact, and taken together, they determine your particular welfare state at the moment, whether it's negative, neutral, or positive.
So it gets pretty complicated pretty quickly with all of those interacting. And so it's kind of like welfare is on a continuum. Is that fair to say?
Most definitely is.
Okay. And it's going back and forth all the time and up and down all the time, however you want to look at it. But okay. So.
But I think an important concept is that it's not something that we give to animals. We don't give them good welfare. We give them good inputs. We hopefully feed them correctly and house them correctly and vaccinate them so they don't get sick, and give them antibiotics if they are sick, etc. So we try to give them the best inputs that we can, but they have to take those inputs and process them, and that is their welfare. I can feed an animal all the best food, but if that animal doesn't like that food or doesn't eat that food,
or it's presented in a way that they prefer not to have it presented as.
Right. So it's not about what we're giving them, although we should obviously need to optimize that if we have any chance of them having good welfare. But it's how they cope with it, what they do with it, how they handle it, that determines what their welfare is.
One of the things I did want to touch on is when we were just briefly talking about the definition and how it's different, is you also mentioned free-ranging wildlife. So animal welfare, often when I've heard it described, has people involved in it. Like you mentioned, you know, zoo animals, animals in rehabilitation, ambassador animals, that kind of thing, some kind of human connection. Free-ranging wildlife, hopefully it doesn't have any of those kinds of connections to humans. So is that a newer type of concept for animal welfare, is to talk about the free-ranging animals? Or is it just, of course they have welfare, right? It doesn't have to have people in it. They have welfare.
Well, and you're correct on both parts.
Okay.
They all have welfare, whether that's positive, neutral, or negative. And just like the ones in captivity, it's going to change from moment to moment. And considering the welfare of free-ranging wildlife is more of a newer concept. Of course, you can always find papers that talked about it a long time ago where that concept was introduced. But as a social and cultural phenomena, free-ranging wildlife, the welfare of free-ranging animals, it's a newer concept than our traditional concepts of animal welfare. Those started, there's always been people who've cared about animal welfare.
Right.
Because we've always had people who, you know, took care of wildlife that they came across that was sick or injured since time began with human beings. But it has expanded and contracted over the centuries. Mm-hmm. If you go back and study it as I am for these animal welfare boards. And what's kind of interesting is that it often follows child welfare. Children and animals were often kind of on the same level. And so when children were experiencing better welfare laws about, you know, how long children could work or not work, they were often applied to, say, the carriage horses, how long they could work or not work.
Isn't that interesting?
So for a lot of our history, our current history, children's welfare and animal welfare were kind of tied together.
Okay.
These societies would look out for the welfare of children and animals.
Okay.
In more recent times, the current concepts that we have for animal welfare are based on, they came out of UK, they came out of England, and it really started with industrialized animal agriculture, when animals started to be more in factory farms than, you know, a few chickens on a farm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of our concerns are driven by society and our culture, and people started to become concerned about it. And so the UK put together a commission called the Bramble Commission to look into the welfare of animals that are used in agriculture. And they came up with a framework called the Five Freedoms. And actually, the Five Freedoms were more of a list of things not to do. It had more to do with neglect or...
hunger, right. And like so taking away hunger or something, right?
Yeah. So freedom from hunger and thirst, mm-hmm. freedom from discomfort, pain, injury, disease. The only real positive one was the freedom to express normal behavior. So they were more about preventing harm and neglect than they were necessarily about providing for good welfare.
Okay.
And so then in the 1990s, a researcher by the name of Malore kind of redirected those five freedoms and turned them into what we call the five domains. And they very much map the five freedoms, but instead of just preventing negative aspects of care, they're encouraging positive aspects. And so you look at the domains of nutrition, environment, health, and behavior, and those together interact to give you your welfare state, which is generally considered your mental sphere.
Okay.
Your emotional sphere.
So in those five domains, we've got kind of the five freedoms already incorporated, right? We've got the negatives that we want to take away, right? The hunger, the thirst, that kind of thing. And then there's positive inputs, correct? To try to, like, presenting water in a way that this particular animal would get water in the wild. Or is that,
yes.
Am I kind of thinking of it the right way?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very much so.
Okay. And we will link to some links in the show notes for folks so they can kind of see where this is coming from if you want to go in deeper and everything. It's fascinating. And then, and I've certainly seen the Find Freedoms around. I think the Humane Society and a few other larger organizations will prominently display the Five Freedoms. And I haven't seen the Five Domains as much, but that certainly resonates with me, being an animal trainer, using positive reinforcement. So, and of course, having pets and things like that, and working in wildlife rehabilitation. Want to try to figure out how to make it the least stressful as possible. So that, but all of these, the Five Freedoms and the Five Domains, most of what they're talking about is the inputs. Is that correct? Well, you were talking about that earlier about, you know, here I'm giving you food, here I'm giving you water, or even I'm presenting the food or water in a certain way. And so, as you mentioned earlier, the inputs are the easy part. It's trying to figure out the other part, too, that the, if the animal actually is experiencing, what kind of welfare the animal is experiencing. Is that correct assumption on that?
Yes, and that's what we were talking about earlier with how the animal is coping with the conditions in which it finds itself. Because we do have these frameworks, and people use these frameworks to assess welfare. And even though they sound somewhat subjective and a little nebulous, you can turn them into an objective framework where you can score these different inputs and outputs. So you've mentioned a lot of the inputs, the food, the housing, the training, your experience taking care of that animal. The animal itself comes with input. It has some genetic background to it, and it has its earlier experiences that also feed into those inputs. And those are fairly easy to quantify. But then we do need to figure out how to measure the outputs, the outputs that the animal is showing us. And those are the more complicated ones. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, the five domains, four of them are basically inputs. And the fifth one is the output. It is the emotional or mental state of the animal that is telling you how it is coping with all of the inputs that you gave it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, some of these are very subjective assessments. Some of them are more objective assessments. But they basically all start with these different frameworks, whether that's five freedoms or five domains or the three spheres that we talked about, or one that you develop on your own. We've done one here at the Raptor Center that basically involves the physical exam and the animal's ethogram or their behavior log based on the questions that we need to answer as far as how they're coping with changes in their caging structures, changing in the medications that we've given them for pain mitigation. So you can devise welfare assessments almost any way that fits the situation, as long as it takes into account those inputs and outputs. Very often they're going to be facility specific or species specific, and sometimes even individual specific. Mm-hmm. So for the raptors that we were talking about, we have an individual raptor that has obviously did not get rehabilitated and released because it has some type of medical, emotional, or behavioral issue, so it couldn't be released. But we need to be sure that we monitor that through this animal's 40-year lifespan.
Right.
And so we'll customize it for this particular animal with its particular needs.
And we've certainly done here at the Raptor Center a lot of baseline information, all the medical stuff that you talked about earlier and particular challenges that animal might have, and then especially with the ethograms or the activity budgets, answering a particular question. But the baseline is great because now if you do develop a challenge, you want to figure out what's going on, or you want to continue to see if this bird is still doing okay in its environment, then now you can kind of compare apples to apples, which is helping to make it a little bit more objective. It's still hard, but it's at least along the way, along the path of trying to figure it out. So awesome. So the three spheres, one of the things that it occurs is we've got five freedoms, five domains, three spheres. Especially with the output part, with the mental output part for like the five domains, that's also incorporated in the three spheres. Do you think the three spheres, looking at that particular model, elevates that particular aspect so people think about it more? Because in the five domains, it's one of five. But in the three spheres, it's one of three. I don't know. It just occurred. I have no idea.
So I do have a tendency to prefer the three spheres. One, we know that humans do better holding three things in their brain than five things in their brain. And I do think it does a better job of incorporating all of the inputs and outputs as a whole and not in categories. The other thing about the three spheres, it was put together by Dr. Fraser, who is an animal welfareist and behaviorist. And in reading how he envisioned this, it also has a tendency to incorporate more of our ethical portions of animal welfare. So unfortunately, animal welfare is a combination of welfare science and our ethical frameworks as well. We just can't divorce that from the welfare science. And to me, those three spheres do a better job of incorporating those together.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I do agree that the three spheres are a lot easier to remember. I totally think it's easier to remember. But all of those frameworks work really, really well. So how do different organizations maybe apply these different frameworks, like whether it's AZA or humane societies or that kind of thing?
So they use these frameworks to develop their assessment tools, because all of us are most concerned that when we have these animals that we are using for our purposes, mm-hmm. whether that is for food or in a research setting or educational ambassador animals, whether we agree with how those animals or whether those animals should be there or not, or be used for that purpose or not, everyone seems to kind of agree that we want them to have the best welfare possible while they're living that life. And so that's where those assessments come into play. It's all very well and good to say, you know, we want to make sure that our animals have the best welfare. These are the frameworks. We're going to make sure that we have all the right inputs, et cetera, et cetera. But again, it has to do with how those animals utilize the inputs that we give to really determine whether they have good welfare or not, which means you have to have some way of assessing them. Zoos have come a long way in the last 15 to 20 years with animal welfare. We now have computer programs that have welfare assessments in them, and you put together a menu of things that you need to be monitoring for that particular exhibit or that particular, a little better to get down to a species level or even an individual level. Mm-hmm. And so they are, the keepers and the curatorial staff track those things over time to be sure that those animals are having the very best welfare. It's a little easier with zoos on the one hand. I mean, I know there's lots of different species in zoos, and so that makes it a lot more complicated. But you have animals for long term, and so you can really get to know that species and that particular individual. they are generally happy. Happy. They're generally happy. Okay.
There we go. Problem solved.
They are generally healthy. Oftentimes they have been captive born in that facility, or at least in captivity. It's more challenging when we go to wildlife rehabilitation, especially the medical phases of wildlife rehabilitation. Animals come in with fractures and trauma, so they have to be treated. There's pain involved. We try to mitigate that with medications. We don't know a lot about all of the different species and how they interact with our medications and dosages and things like that. So we do our very best by that, but it is harder to do assessments of animals when they're undergoing wildlife rehabilitation. Think about the difference between doing a quality of life assessment for your dog as it ages and has kidney problems, or has to have some chemotherapy for cancer. It's much easier for you to do assessments of that animal than it is for trying to do an assessment of a free-ranging wild animal,
right,
and what their welfare is like.
Right.
So these assessments can get quite complicated sometimes.
Very quickly, I was just thinking of those two examples, and I'm like, yeah, I could definitely see the welfare, kind of helping to assess the welfare of the dog, being easier in one sense, harder in another sense, but easier in one sense than it would be with free-ranging wildlife, or wildlife in rehabilitation care too, might be a challenge. But
it was very similar in human care with physicians. If you think about the origins of rest homes and nursing homes.
Mm-hmm.
They're called nursing homes because you went there for medical issues. They never really considered your emotional issues or your social and environmental issues. And those have come along afterwards. And so now we have more like hospice care and you staying in your home because that's the environment where you're most comfortable with, and having nursing care come to you there. Because again, they're they're ahead of us. They are looking at the total package for this particular person. And in this book, he actually started using the words choice and control, which I have heard you say many, many times when we're dealing with different animals, and whether that's based on their training that you're working on or whether we're talking about their welfare. So it was fascinating to me to see this overlap with how welfare has changed in our society, animal welfare has changed in our society and our culture, and how it very much was being mapped ahead of us in the human healthcare fields.
Wow. And I am assuming, I know that you wouldn't have the answer to this, at least I don't think you would, but you've referred to our culture, everything, so we're, American culture, basically, but this journey, this animal welfare journey, must be different in different cultures.
It very much so is. It is driven by society. It is driven by your economic status. It can be driven by your religious backgrounds. And so it all mixed together in this milieu that creates the culture that you are living in. And our concerns about animal welfare in the United States and in Europe, UK, Australia, are changing very, very rapidly. And sometimes it's almost hard to keep up with it. if you've gone to the grocery store lately, and if you eat meat, You see that there are packages of meat now that are stamped as humane certified. If you buy clothing, you will find clothing that has a little label that says, you know, humanely harvested. So whether you're talking about leather or whether you're talking about shearing wool, you know, how are those animals treated in order to obtain those products that we're using them?
Right. And I do remember way back when, you know, I was always looking for shampoo, and I still do, that is labeled with a little rabbit that says cruelty-free on it. So that was like the very small beginnings, maybe, of what is happening now. And I certainly have seen things with eggs, certainly with meat as well, whether it's pasture-raised or, like you said, humanely harvested type of language on there. So, and I, for one, am very glad for that type of labeling. Because I've mentioned on the podcast before that I'm a vegetarian. And the reason I'm a vegetarian is not because I don't like meat, not because I think that all of us should be, we should all eat lower on the food chain, but not that I'm against eating meat. I'm not. The challenge was, and I wish I would have known a lot of this that we're talking about today. I wish I would have known that 30 years ago, because I decided to become a vegetarian because I thought we could do so much better by the livestock. I did not like how they were treated, especially cows. My grandparents were farmers, but it was one of those small farms like you were talking about earlier. So I had a framework of what I already thought how cows should be taken care of, and knowing how most cows are taken care of, I didn't approve, and I decided I better walk the talk, and so that's why I decided to become vegetarian. But so this is a nice, seeing a nice progression.
Well, and as you pointed out, it basically started in animal agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
When we started to treat them more like machines as opposed to animals, and that's what started the Bramble Commission and the Five Freedoms. The next big iteration in animal welfare had to do with animal research. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of the Animal Welfare Act. It is our only federal regulation for animal welfare. Interestingly enough, the Animal Welfare Act does not define welfare.
I find that so funny. Well, we'll call it animal welfare, but we won't define it. Okay, so the Animal Welfare Act doesn't define animal welfare.
No, it really doesn't. So first of all, you need to recognize that your cruelty and neglect laws are state laws. So as far as, you know, not taking care of your horse or abusing the neighbor's dog, those are state laws. The Animal Welfare Act was originally passed because a pet dog by the name of Pepper was stolen. This was a very common practice to steal dogs, and the people would sell them into research. And so the dog Pepper was stolen and was sold into research. They did eventually track Pepper down, but Pepper was no longer with us at that point in time. And there was, again, a change in society, a change in culture, a shift that said, this is not something that we want in our society with our animals. So that was passed in 1966, and it sets standards for the humane care and treatment for certain species that are undergoing certain activities. So it has to be a covered species, and it has to be a covered activity. So some of those activities are exhibited to the public, so like zoos and those type of facilities. Animals that are being sold as pets, again, making sure that they were not obtained feloniously. Those that are being used in research or being transported commercially. It has been updated many, many times since the 60s. But again, it's very narrowly crafted for certain species that are undergoing certain activities. So a good example is a horse. A horse as a pet is not covered. A horse on a farm is not covered. If you have a horse that is being used in research, it is covered. So it has to be a covered species, and it has to be a covered activity.
Would something like, and you may not know the answer to this, a horse driving a carriage in Central Park, would that then be covered, or is that, do you know?
That would most likely be covered by your state.
Okay, okay, by the state.
State laws.
Thank you.
For cruelty and neglect.
Great.
And by species, I'm, for the most part, it was mammal-based. And I can't remember all the details, but punctuation is important. Your English teacher was correct way, way, way back in your childhood, because there was a comma somewhere that for the longest time, as people read the statute, birds were excluded. And then that was re-examined as to what that particular, I'm pretty sure it was a comma, where that particular punctuation was. And they said, no, no, birds are covered. So as very recently, birds are now being covered under the Animal Welfare Act.
As most of us listening, especially if you have ambassador animals, well know the fervor this has caused.
Yeah. So those, the policies around covering birds have recently been finalized and have been published. And so people who are using birds, again, birds not bred for research, but birds, will be now be covered under the Animal Welfare Act. So when the USDA inspectors come to your local zoo, not only will they be looking at most of the mammals, not all of them, but they'll also be looking at most of the birds.
Wow. And it is the U.S. Department of Agriculture that kind of oversees the Animal Welfare Act.
USDA APHIS Animal Care oversees the Animal Welfare Act.
Okay. Wow.
And so they will be coming to the Raptor Center at some point in time.
I sure will. I do know, and at a future episode, we'll be talking a little bit more in depth about this as more and more details are known and the folks at the USDA and APHIS are done with all their webinars and things like that trying to explain it. I've attended a lot of them. But it, as far as the Animal Welfare Act, that does not impact wildlife rehabilitation.
It does not. Wildlife rehabilitation is covered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the migratory bird portions of it, and it is covered by your state, usually Department of Fish and Game, for your terrestrials. If you're doing marine mammals, they're going to be covered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA, depending upon what species it is. So not USDA Animal Care.
Well, this conversation has been phenomenal as far as like almost full circle, right? To talk about the beginnings, your beginnings in animal welfare, but also how animal welfare has developed over time and with culture and society and things like that. And the different types of frameworks that you can, that have been reflective of animal welfare and its kind of growth, dare I say, or changes?
Evolution.
Evolution. I like that better. Evolution. And a little bit about how these frameworks can be applied and right to the federal Animal Welfare Act, which again does not affect wildlife rehabilitation, but I think that this is just a well-rounded background, I hope, for everyone. Today. So I want to thank you for that. But now we're going to switch gears. Because what I would like to do is talk about how animal welfare can be applied to wildlife rehabilitation. I mean, how do we get to a point, and I'm sure a lot of people actually are there, they just don't, I want them to be intentionally there. Thinking about animal welfare at all these different points in a rehabilitation, an animal coming into rehabilitation. So whether it's tools or thought process or those kinds of things, I thought that maybe we could explore that a little bit.
So one of the approaches that I like to use with my veterinary students, and we also have interns that come here to the Raptor Center to learn raptor medicine and surgery, is, again, I like those Venn diagrams, those three overlapping circles. And so the approach that I take is we have three spheres that influence animal welfare as our animals are undergoing wildlife rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So the first sphere is regulatory. We mentioned the fact that you're either going to be working under U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plus or minus a couple other federal agencies plus or minus your state agency. And they all have policies written about what you can and cannot do with animals undergoing wildlife rehabilitation. So it very much impacts some of your very first decisions that you're going to make, whether to rehabilitate that animal or to humanely euthanize it based on what type of issues that it is presented with. The second sphere that I want them to consider is best practices and whether those are evidence-based science best practices, because we've done research on it and we have determined this is the appropriate way to handle this animal with that issue, mm-hmm. or whether those are best practices from professional organizations, whether that be Association of Zoo Vets or the National Wildlife Rehabilitation Association or any number of professional organizations that deal with animals, their health, their issues, their husbandry, their management. You want to take those best practices, and that is your next level of decision making. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to, it is going to inform how you are going to move forward with that animal in its rehabilitation journey. The last circle that you have to consider are ethics, because consciously or unconsciously, it is going to influence how you make decisions. And we have both professional ethics and personal ethics. So our professional ethics, veterinarians have a list of professional ethics that they are to abide by. Wildlife rehabilitators have a list of ethics that you are to mm-hmm. abide by. I know you discussed them in your ethics podcast that yes. I listened to not too shortly ago. But you also have your personal ethics. And again, part of that is the society and the culture in which you were raised. But at some point in time, you start making your own personal value judgments based on your experiences. And that will influence the decisions that you make with this animal as it goes through the rehabilitation process. And as I mentioned, ethics are tightly integrated into animal welfare. We're doing better science. We do more science. But still, ethics mm-hmm. is going to always be a part of it. And much like welfare being tied to children, when ethics first came about as a philosophy, it had nothing to do with animals. It had to do with how you were relating to your fellow man.
Okay.
And one of the most common ones is the utilitarian theory of ethics, utilitarianism, which basically says the best thing to do is what is best for the greatest number of people. It's been paraphrased. It's not quite what it said, but that's what most people go with.
Okay.
But you can see how just because it benefits the most number of people, the greatest number of people, doesn't necessarily mean it's always the best thing to do, because what about all the rest of the people
right.
that it doesn't benefit?
Mm-hmm.
And But ethics were all about person-to-person relationships. They had nothing to do with animals. We have tried applying them to animals. And as we've gone through, we said, well, you know, we can use the utilitarian ethic and just apply it to animals instead. But there are some issues with that. So much like our animal welfare has evolved, our ethics have evolved. And we now have ethics that are written completely around animals, not necessarily involving humans. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that works very well
either. Right.
My current favorite ethic is called the practical ethic. It's was put together by Dr. Fraser, mm-hmm. the gentleman put together the three spheres. And to me, it very much applies to wildlife rehabilitation and the whole one health and one welfare concept, because it talks about both intentional and unintentional harms and being aware of environmental harms as well as pain and suffering to animals. So,
exactly.
I really like that one.
Dr. Mitch, I want to thank you so much for your time today to talk about animal welfare. And I promised, and I think we delivered, on that animal welfare is a pretty interesting topic. Not only a little bit of the history, but about how it intertwines with pretty much everything that we do with animals in our life, not just in wildlife rehabilitation, but of course, that's an important piece for everyone listening, but also whether it's livestock or pets, or dare I say each other, right? So thank you very much again for joining me. And we will have a lot of information in the show notes for everyone, and hope to have you back.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Always willing to talk about this some more.
That was my recent discussion with Dr. Michelle Ouellette on animal welfare. Be sure to stay tuned and stay in touch with us, because we plan to meet again and talk more on the subject when time allows. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release Season 2. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Clocky. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Michelle Ouellette, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.